welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis and want to improve your game, this podcast is for you. Whether it's technique, strategy, equipment, or the mental game, tennis professional Ian Westerman is here to make you a better player. And now, here's Ian.
Hi, and welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast, your place for free, expert tennis instruction that can truly help you improve your game. Well, today on episode number 43, I have Dr. Jack back on the program. We're going to talk about a listener question having to do with shin splints and also stress fractures in your lower leg. So if that's something that you have struggled with in the past or something that you're struggling with now, you definitely want to pay close attention to what Dr. Jack has to say there. After that, I'm going to be discussing a couple different topics having to do with preparation in your tennis game, specifically how to prepare your body for certain strokes, what position to put your body in. I'm also going to talk about when to prepare and exactly when during a specific type of shot you're supposed to prepare your body, the timing of your preparation. And lastly, I'm going to talk about the use of your non-dominant hand. And a couple of different topics having to do with that, not necessarily all specifically on preparation, but having to do with that as well. So let's get down to business, sit back, relax, and get ready for some great tennis instruction.
And now it's time for Essential Tennis Sports Medicine Talk with Dr. Jack Kripsack.
Hi, Dr. Jack. How are you doing?
Great, Ian. Yourself?
Very well. Thank you. Are you getting all your stuff set for the holidays, your decorations and shopping and all that?
We're working on it. Coming off Thanksgiving, getting ready for Christmas. Things are progressing nicely around the household. The tree's up. Most of the packages are done, and I think we're well on our way.
Nice.
How about you?
Yeah. My wife and I did most of our decorating last weekend. On the shopping front, as always, I'm far behind. I'm not sure I can really say I've started yet, so I've got a ways to go there, but I'll catch up eventually.
That's good.
Well, let's answer a listener question. It's good to have you back on the podcast.
Always a pleasure.
I got a question, and I know you saw this as well on the forums from Kent. And his question was, Dr. Jack, can you fill us in on what exactly shin splints are and how they differ from stress fractures? Also, how do you tell which you may have, along with treatment and prevention for each? Thanks, Kent. So tell us, Dr. Jack, what are shin splints exactly?
This is definitely a good topic. Shin splints occur from a weakness of muscles that cause your foot to what we call dorsiflex or flex back towards your leg. So the top of your foot comes back towards your leg as opposed to the bottom of the foot going down towards the ground as if you were pointing your toes, and that's called plantar flexion. Mm-hmm. So as we go through this, the difference is plantar flexion, you're pointing your foot like someone that's coming off a diving board, and as you hit the water, your toes are supposed to be plantar flexed and straight out. And dorsiflexion, you're creating that right angle between your foot and your lower leg. So what happens in shin splints is the muscle, the soleus muscle, which is mainly responsible for this dorsiflexion action, is weakened, and it can't keep up with the stress of running. Shin splints occur in tennis players from a lot of movement around, forward, backward, side to side on the court, and more typically on someone that's going to play on asphalt than would play on hard true clay courts or grass courts where the surface is a little softer.
Okay.
The harder surface drives more what we call ground reaction forces into the bone and causes the stress. And in essence, what happens is the soleus muscle starts to actually tear away from the bone. It starts to separate off the bone.
Ouch.
And that's, yeah, exactly. It can be very painful, and that's where you start to get this problem. The pain is typically noticed about two-thirds of the way down from the knee to the ankle, and that's a classic area that you'll have the shin splints. And some of the things that are risk factors for this are if you're what we call an overpronator, where your foot rolls in too much or almost gives like a flat-footed appearance, or having flat feet will also create it.
Okay.
What we call the gait line, or the line of force through your foot, becomes a straight line, as opposed to as your heel strikes the ground, your foot kind of rolls out towards the side and then comes back in towards the middle and goes off the ball of your foot. It creates kind of an S curve. Now, if your gait line is straight as an arrow, then that again drives the forces of the ground versus the leg into the tibia or the shin bone, and that's where you start to get this pressure on the soleus muscle pulling it off the bone.
Okay.
Tight hamstrings can increase this, can contribute to this, as well as what we call the increased Q angle, which occurs in women where there's an angle from the hip to the knee to the ankle, and it kind of like knock-kneed appearance, and the more knock-kneed someone is, the greater the Q angle, the greater the stress on the tibia, and more likely to cause the shin splints.
I see.
These typically will occur, what we say, insidious and onset slow. They will occur over time. You will wake up and start to notice they're a little achy, and they just get progressively worse. It's not usually due to one specific traumatic injury. They occur over time. And they're going to hurt more as you run, and they're going to ache when you're done, and your legs are going to feel restless at night, and just have this very achy feel to them.
Sure.
And when you know, when someone will come into my office, what we'll do is, and when Kent's asking about the difference between shin splints and stress fractures, you'll actually have a fracture or a break in the bone, little microfractures in the tibia itself, the shin bone, which is pretty significant, because that shin bone is probably the strongest weight-bearing bone in the body. I've seen people get hit with baseball bats and steel girders and not break that bone. So this repetitive trauma that you have to incur over time to cause these fractures is pretty significant. So as you hit your shin and you walk down and you get about two-thirds of the way down, if you press on a muscle and you come back from the shin bone, you'll see is the shin bone will have like a little ledge on it, and then it drops off to the side. Now, if you press on the muscle and the muscle hurts and the bone doesn't hurt, then you pretty much know it's shin splints.
Okay.
If the bone hurts more than the muscle, then you start thinking stress fractures.
Okay. So ultimately, with the on the shin splint side of things, ultimately that separation from the muscle and the bone, is that more so typically due to poor technique in running or in athletic things, or is it more due to lack of strength and not good enough conditioning there?
Lack of strength of the dorsiflexor muscles and
okay.
Mostly the soleus. So the soleus is weak, or you're flat-footed, and those are probably going to be, or your gait line, you have that overpronation. Those are really the biggest factors for this.
Gotcha. So lastly then, please tell us, how do you treat these problems, and also is there a way to prevent them from occurring in the first place?
The best way to actually treat and prevent them is to strengthen the soleus muscle, the dorsiflexors of the ankle. So you want to get some exercise tubing and wrap it around the top of your foot and then connect it to a distal area and flex the ankle backwards so that the top of your foot and your toes come back towards you.
Okay.
15 repetitions of that, both feet to keep a balance, even if you just have shin splints on one side. And, you know, once or twice a day you want to do that. We want to do it for preventative, three times a week is sufficient. For treatment, you want to go about five times a week should be fine. And that's an excellent exercise for that. Also, you can do exercises where you walk on your heels back and forth, you know, maybe 5 to 10 yards, and walk on your toes back and forth 5 to 10 yards. Try to strengthen up your lower extremity muscles, which is a good idea. The exercise tubing one's probably the best.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing you might want to look into, if this doesn't help, is to look into custom orthotics to correct any of this overpronation that you may have, and that's
sure.
Usually pretty easy to do. I, you know, in our office we have this nice FootMax thing, which I know I've talked about before, and there are shoe stores that have those available around the country. Even if you don't get to a physician or a podiatrist, you can go to some of these shoe places that you can walk in and they can do the gait analysis and make the custom shoe and put the orthotic right into your sneaker or your dress shoe for you, which is really nice.
Yeah, I think that's actually the brand that I use in my tennis shoes.
Oh, cool.
I have flat feet, so yeah, okay. I used to get custom ones, but I had a runner recommend to me. I'm pretty sure it was FootMax or FeetMax. Is it or FootMax?
Which FootMax?
Mm-hmm. FootMax, yeah.
Yeah. It's a great system, that FootMax thing. I mean, it's really used by the vast majority of professional athletes. You know, most of the guys in the NFL, the NBA, almost everybody in Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
Even NHL, we can make them for hockey. So it's a company out of Canada. I know I've talked about it before. They've really marketed themselves well, and they do a really, really nice job.
Cool.
I just want to get back to one other thing about the differentiation between the shin splints and the stress fractures, which is very important.
Sure.
If you go in to see your physician and you're concerned about, you know, identifying the difference, your physician will probably want to start with a set of x-rays. And most times the x-rays are going to be normal. You're not going to see much unless you see something called the dreaded black line. And that is a black horizontal line that comes across your bone on x-ray. And that is a real bad actor because those have a high incidence of non-healing and often require a surgical intervention to correct those.
Uh-oh.
But the other thing is, if your x-rays are normal and your physician still suspects or you're worried about stress fractures, the next test to get would be either a bone scan or an MRI scan. Your insurance company will probably want you to get the bone scan because it's less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But the MRI scan, it's done with magnets and there's no radiation, so it's safer. The cost is probably $200 versus $1,000. That's why your insurance company is going to want you to get the bone scan. But either way, if these shin splints are becoming problematic and you have that bony tenderness, you really should progress to get one of those other two tests to determine the difference to make sure it's not a stress fracture. Because then the treatment becomes putting you in a air cast for about 3 to 4 weeks. And it's a long leg air cast. So you may see people that have twisted their ankle and they get those plastic splints with the air cells in between and you wrap the Velcro strap around. And those are great for sprained ankles. If you have a stress fracture, you get the long ones that come all the way up just below your knee, and you wear that all during the day. You can take them off when you sleep at night or when you shower, but when you're up walking around or doing anything during the day, you wear that for like 3 weeks, and the healing rate with those is tremendous. There was one study that showed that stress fractures with an air cast healed in 3 weeks. Without an air cast, it took like 10 weeks to heal.
Wow.
Which is a huge difference, a huge difference. And I don't think any of our competitive athletes or even recreational athletes wants to be out 10 weeks for something that could be fixed in 3.
Sure.
So that's a good thing to get. So, you know, the important things are, you know, do some exercises, look into custom orthotics, and make sure that you don't miss the stress fractures because those can really, really be problematic.
So if it is, in fact, stress fractures, I'm assuming then that the exercises that you recommended earlier with the tubing and the walking, that probably won't do anything for it, I would assume?
Well, you know, you want to do those again to prevent a future problem.
Okay, even stress fracture related?
Sure. Okay. You still want to do those to strengthen the muscle to make sure this doesn't come back. But those can help reduce some of the pain and strengthen up that soleus muscle while you're healing the stress fracture and the air cast. But you still should want to do those to help prevent a further injury.
Gotcha. Okay, great. Well, anything else to add before we wrap up?
No, I think that's it. You know, this is pretty cut and dry and with just some very, you know, timely things to do. And the only other thing is, and this is more for runners, I know we had that one listener that was doing a lot of training for triathlons. And for anyone that does other sports, if you have something like shin splints or worried about stress fractures and you notice that when you're running your toes start to go numb and you get a throbbing in your leg or a sharp pain in your leg, this may be something known as a compartment syndrome, which is a pressure in the leg tissue and the leg musculature swells. And that's something that definitely needs to be addressed by your physician. And that's a different topic and probably wouldn't come around very much. But just for the listeners to be aware that if they're playing and their toes start to go numb, that they really should have that addressed by their physician expediently.
Yeah, that's probably never a good thing, huh?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Jack, as always, thanks so much for your expertise and helping of my listeners of the Essential Tennis Podcast. Ken, hopefully that answers your question. And if you have anything further to ask the good doctor or any questions or anything, feel free to post in the forums. All right. Well, Dr. Jack, thanks again. And it's great to have you back on the show. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yeah, that sounds great, Ian. Listen, enjoy the holiday season. And we'll probably be back to see you for 2009. And to all the listeners, keep those cards and letters, or in this instance, emails coming, because I know we've got some cool things to talk about.
Definitely. All right, great. Well, thanks very much. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care.
The Essential Tennis Podcast is brought to you by
Bridgewater Medical Group. Is a multi-specialty medical group located in Bridgewater, New Jersey, and is your home for primary care, gastroenterology, sports medicine, and general internal medicine. They offer a broad array of on-site, state-of-the-art services to make your healthcare experience more pleasurable. Scheduled appointments are preferred, but physician assistants are available for walk-in care. For more information, call Bridgewater Medical Group at 908-722-0808.
For more information on sponsors of the Essential Tennis Podcast or to become a sponsor, visit www.essentialtennis.com.
All right, so now let's move on and talk about preparation in your tennis game. This applies to basically every shot in tennis besides your serve. Yes, there is preparation involved in your serve as well. However, not in the same sense as when the ball is coming towards you and you don't have direct control over how the ball is coming to your side of the court. Now, what's the definition of preparation? Basically, the purpose of preparation is to put your body in a good position and with enough time to make a comfortable swing. Those are the two main elements of preparation as you play your points in tennis, is the position you put yourself in and also the amount of time you leave yourself to actually make your swing. Those are the two most important variables in preparing your body in preparation. So let's talk about those two elements one at a time, and then we're also going to discuss the use of your non-dominant hand we're going to talk about what it has to do with your preparation and a couple other things as well. So first of all, let's talk about positioning. Again, the definition of preparation is putting your body in a good position with enough time to make a comfortable swing. The first part of that is position. Now, what position you put your body in is going to depend on what stroke you're preparing to hit. However, every stroke in tennis, when hit effectively, has one thing in common as far as position goes. And that is turning and rotating your core to the side is what each shot has in common as you play your tennis points and as you try to prepare for each shot. Rotation of your core is essential to virtually every shot in tennis. So priority number one in terms of preparation is turning your core to whichever side the ball is coming to, either to the right or to the left. This applies to every single ground stroke. It applies to every overhead. It applies to volleys and half volleys as well. On ground strokes and overheads, you want to be turned at least 90 degrees with your core, meaning basically from your waist up, you want your body to be rotated to the side, either to the right or to the left, whichever side the ball is coming to, at least 90 degrees on your ground strokes and on your overheads. On volleys and on half volleys, shots where you're not trying to generate as much power and it's more of a control shot, more of a touch shot, you still do want to rotate your core, although not as much as necessary. You only need about 45 degrees on average for a volley or for a half volley. However, it does depend on the shot, the exact shot in question, and on the point situation. There will be some volleys and some half volleys where turning 90 degrees is going to be most beneficial. And I'm not going to go into tons of detail and talk about specific instances, but just let it be said that at least 45 degrees is going to be necessary in order to make use of your core which is the strongest part of your body and needs to be used to hit an effective shot. One last thing I'll say on the rotation of the core, as it has to do with volleys, there will be some times when you're at the net, when your opponent hits a good enough shot or your opponent is close enough to you, that you just don't have enough time physically to turn yourself to the side, and you're relinquished to just putting your racket behind the ball and blocking it back. And that's perfectly fine. You won't always have time in tennis to put yourself in a perfect position in order to hit the next shot. You just have to do your best. The important thing is knowing what the best position is in order to hit an effective shot, and then do your best to put yourself in that position over and over and over. That's your goal. And if on a particular shot you don't have time, or if you misjudge the ball and you get put out of position and your preparation is not very good, then, well, that will happen. Just make sure you make a note of it and you improve yourself on whatever happened that went wrong in that particular shot next time. So that's position. We want our body turned to the side, period. That's the one commonality we have between every shot. I could go through and talk about each individual shot and the specific positions you want each of your body parts to be in. I'm not going to do that right now. That would be a couple of podcasts worth of material probably. Now let's go on to time. The second part of the definition of preparation is giving yourself enough time to make a comfortable swing. Now the pros typically time their preparations with the oncoming ball, meaning oftentimes they time it with the bounce so that there's a smooth and continuous motion back and forth. So as the ball comes to them, they're moving their feet very quickly. They're taking a lot of steps, positioning their body as a whole in relation to where the ball is, so that the ball is going to be around waist height and they can make a good, comfortable swing. Preparation-wise, as far as their body is concerned, in terms of the rotation of their body, oftentimes they'll wait and time their take back. They'll time their core preparation with the bounce, so that as the ball is bouncing, they're taking their body back, and then they're moving forwards again right away into the point of contact. So there's a smooth and a kind of a smooth tempo back and then forth, and then back and then forth, as opposed to taking their body back really early and waiting with their core rotated and kind of waiting for the ball to get there, and then making their forward rotation towards the ball whenever it gets to the right point. Usually the pros are making one smooth, long motion back and then forth. There are exceptions to this, but what I just described is pretty typical. There are some players that will take their racket back and their core back. They'll rotate and prepare with their core very, very early, and they will wait for the ball for a long period of time, relatively speaking. But for the most part, they're rotating back and then forth, and then back and then forth in one smooth motion. Now, that's professional players. Amateur players from beginner on up through about 3.5 or so typically are late the majority of the time when they do miss time shots, meaning being too late or too early with their swing. The majority of the time, beginner players on through up about 3.5, in my experience, very often are late, much, much more than they are early. This is why the term racket back has been so prevalent among teaching pros for a long time. For a long time, that was kind of the first instruction that was being yelled across the net by teaching pros, was racket back, prepare your racket, take the racket back as soon as you see that the ball is coming. Over the years, I've learned to not like that term very much. And the reason for that is I want to make sure that your whole body is being prepared and not just the racket. I believe that for below a 4.0 player, if you're not at a 4.0 level yet, your preparation really can't be too early. So I do want you to take your core back as a whole with the racket. Your body and your racket should move back together. And if you're below a 4.0 player, I really don't think you can be too early in preparing your body. And the reason for that is what I just said a second ago. The vast majority of players in that range of levels is going to be late when they do miss time shots. So rather than be kind of trying to time your swing perfectly, wait for the ball, and take your body back and then forwards like the pros and try to time it perfectly. I would rather that you take your body back and prepare as early as possible, as soon as you see what kind of shot is coming, and then time your forward swing, the rotation of your body forwards, with the oncoming ball. As you become better and you develop more as a player, your timing and your judgment increases. Then there's nothing wrong with starting to make it a little more fluid and smooth, rather than take your body back and wait for the ball to get to you. You just have to realize that, yes, the pros do make it one fluid big motion, but you have to understand how advanced they are and how easy they make it look, because they're extremely, extremely talented. Do yourself a favor. If you're below a 4.0 level, take it back nice and early. Give yourself lots of time to be able to position yourself and then make a comfortable swing without being rushed. Last thing I'll say, again, just to reiterate, the most important thing out of all of this is that your core is rotating. Your core is what is taking the racket back. And I'd rather you do this sooner rather than later, because being a little bit early is, in general, is going to be better than being a little bit late and being rushed. Okay, lastly, let's talk about the use of your non-dominant hand and how it can help your tennis game. Your opposite hand can help a great deal in preparing your body correctly. The large majority of pro players use it to push their racket back from their ready position, therefore turning their entire upper body. In a ready position, typically, you'll have both hands on the racket. You should have both hands on the racket in front of you, your racket kind of right in the middle in front of you as you're facing forwards towards the net. If you take your non-dominant hand for a forehand ground stroke, so you're right-handed, and so you'll take your left hand, and from your ready position and in holding your overall position, in your ready position, if you take your left hand and push the racket back to your right to prepare for a forehand ground stroke, that should turn your entire upper body, your whole core. This is how the vast majority of upper-level players prepare for their ground strokes, is by using their non-dominant hand to push the racket back and therefore rotating their entire core. This is done rather than just taking the racket back using your dominant hand and just taking the racket back out of the left hand and just taking it back to the right. That takes the racket back, however, it leaves your core facing forwards. And so while your racket may be prepared, your body is not in the best position possible to hit a strong shot. The non-dominant hand will push the racket back instead, and then that turns your body, your whole body at the same time. Not necessarily your stance, but your upper body should rotate to whichever side you're going to hit on. On a one-handed backhand, the non-dominant hand can play a large role as well, and it can be used to pull the racket back rather than push, and the core again will rotate along with it. I have two other quick things here. The opposite hand can serve at least two other functions as well. Besides helping the body rotate and turn the upper part of your body, it can also help the dominant hand relax between shots by supporting the weight of the racket. And for me, this is done especially at the net, although I know that I do it pretty much after every shot. I make my swing, I go back to my ready position and put my non-dominant hand back on the racket, and then my non-dominant hand can support the racket, and my dominant hand can relax, can loosen on the grip and just rest for a second or a half a second or however long it might be. That's going to allow your dominant arm, your entire arm really, to loosen and relax. And that way you don't have constant stress on your hand and on your arm. It can help you loosen up and relax. For me, this happens especially at the net in a really quick exchange. When you hit a volley and then go back to a ready position, my right hand, I'm left-handed, my right hand immediately goes back to the racket. Both hands go back in front, so I'm prepared for the next shot. And I know my left hand then loosens and relaxes so that I can firm it again very quickly if I have to prepare for a quick reaction volley on the next shot. If my left hand stayed the dominance support of the racket the entire time, it would get tired very quickly without any help from my other hand, since I use one hand for both a forehand and a backhand volley. My left hand would get tired very quickly. So that's another way you can use your non-dominant hand to help you in your game. Lastly, I know that for myself personally, and I've taught this to several students, I use my non-dominant hand to be more aware of the racket face angle as I take my racket back for ground strokes. I have a one-handed backhand, so I put my non-dominant hand on the throat of the racket and actually put my index finger up on the crease between the kind of the hoop or the head of the racket and the throat of the racket. The throat comes up from the handle and attaches to the side of the racket head. And I put my index finger right on the crease there where the throat and the head meets. And as I take my racket back on my forehand and on my backhand, I can use that index finger to kind of feel where the racket face is, how open or closed it is, depending on what type of shot I'm about to attempt, whether it be topspin or slice or a lob or a drop shot or whatever. I use my non-dominant hand to get a feel for how I'm setting my racket up for that next particular shot on ground strokes or for volleys. I put my index finger in that same spot on my volleys as well. So you can kind of use it to become more aware of what's going on with your racket as you prepare to hit. Okay, that brings the Essential Tennis Podcast episode number 43 to a close. Thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate your support by downloading the podcast. Keep in mind, guys, that I have that contest running through this time next week. I'm going to be announcing the winner of the three sets of strings and the three grips next week, which is the 15th. All you have to do is go to the forums at essentialtennis.com, click on general discussion, and then click on contest. And all you have to do is make a post saying what your tennis New Year's resolution is for 2009. I'll then randomly select somebody from whoever posts there. We already have lots of posts already from listeners and from readers at EssentialTennis.com. Lots of great ideas, things to work on for each individual player. It's great to see that so many people are dedicated to improving their game. And sometime this week, I'm going to post my own New Year's resolution as well. I have something I've really been working hard on in my own game, and I hope to really nail it down in 2009. So that brings today to a close. Thanks again for joining me. Have a great week, everybody. Take care, and good luck with your tennis.